Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 56 of season 5 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Little Eddie from the Super Live Adventure Podcast. Welcome back, Eddie.
Hey Rob, thank you so much for having me back. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's because you wanted to be back. You know, the other when you don't want to be here, I don't force you. I'm not going to come down
Oh,
there and
damn
break your
it.
legs and make sure the come join me. You know,
Yeah,
we
no, I'm
almost saw
happy.
Goodfellas together, so you know that's why. You know, I know. It's I
Oh, that's
decided
right.
I didn't
Yes.
want to go to Goodfellas with you because I was afraid you're going to break my legs.
No. I may live in the area, but that's not really protocol around Staten Island.
I'm very happy to hear that. At least not now. Maybe in the 80s it was, you're saying, but not this time of year.
Times change. Times change.
That is true. All right, so episode 56 begins with John picking up his equipment from the snow and ends with John trying to wave them off. So we ended things on Friday with a very strange predicament. You know, we see that Colonel Stewart wants to try and do something. We're not really sure. Something anywhere in between, killing cops and an atom bomb. And he seems to have found something, in between. And we discussed it in depth last week at how implausible it is to be able to change the ILS system so that the plane will think it's 200 feet lower than it really is. But whatever, we're not going to go there this week. Last week we had, an expert on aviation talk about that, and I am not an expert on that. And as far as I know, Eddie, you're not either. So, we'll leave that to the
Yeah.
expert.
Well, at this point, this is what Rennie wanted to do when we're going to do anything we can to justify
Yes,
it.
that's true. Yeah, that's more or less what a lot of this movie is. You know, there's a lot of things that happen here that are just completely implausible in our world, but apparently in the world that Die Hard 2 takes place, it's plausible and it's possible. And there you go. I'm a firm believer. I just leave it at that. I don't try to figure that out for myself anyway. No need. It's just the way it is. Yeah. So, that we ended things with John jumping out the window and somehow doing a Rapunzel style, climb down. He very rapidly is able to tie together all of these sheets or something. It drop cloths, I think they are. You know, he very quickly and is able to rappel down one flight. He's pretty lucky that he doesn't have to go very far in order to get down there. You know, and we had seen that he threw, like two pieces of piping and a canister of turpentine onto the fake snow on the ground, because as anyone who knows anything about the making of this movie, there is absolutely no real snow in this movie ever, no
Good
matter how
God,
hard they try. I mean, I don't know. Have you listened to the commentary on this movie?
I actually just this morning before we were recording, I was listening to
Okay.
some of the commentary and the story that Rennie Harlan tells
About are you talking about
about
the
the one
ice? You're
time
talking about the
that they
ice?
thought they were going to have real snow in
Yes.
Spokane, Washington.
That's right.
It is so tragic to hear him. They get off the plane. It's fine. He gets his first good night's sleep in like 10 months
And
and then
there's
wakes up
snow
and there
on
was
the
a heat wave
no,
and
one
the snow
second.
was
First,
flying.
there's snow on the ground, and the place is covered in snow. And they wake up in the morning, there was a heat wave at night, melted all the snow, and they were trucking in snow from Canada. And when that snow got there, it was all frozen because it apparently, it defrosted and then froze. So they had ice. And then there's the other problem that they put down all of these snow blankets to make it look like there was snow. And then they had problems that all got ripped up by the low flying plane that they used this week. So yeah, this is not a good week. If you're just listening to those 5 minutes of Rennie's commentary, you're not going to hear any good stories. I mean, well, sorry, let me rephrase that. You hear some great stories, but you're not going to hear any positive stories about them being able to get the snow. That's what it comes down.
Yeah, I do find it very funny about, you know, this confident, you know, Finnish Viking, you know, saying, oh, we could do anything with, you know, we could do anything with snow. I know how to do snow. And then trying, you know, it's the one winter they're trying to find snow in America, and it's just not there.
Yeah. This movie was really plagued by it. They went to so many different places where you would expect in January or February there would be tons of snow. They were in Washington. They were in Denver. Mm-hmm. They were in Washington, D.C. Michigan. They were in Michigan, up the UP, which I almost was there when they were filming it, but never didn't make it. Told that story too many times. People are probably saying, "Ah, I've heard that story too many times." You know, I mean, me and a friend almost we wanted to answer the call for extras, but they were filming all night and it didn't work out for us. So, you know, we didn't go. And hence, I'm not in this movie, at least even at a glimpse, to say, hey, look, there's me in the back. I'm, you know, maybe I would have been in this week's scenes. Who knows? You know, they were looking for people who would play like firemen and medics and stuff like that, from what I understand. I always thought it was the final scene of the movie, but it could be this one also. What we're gonna get to later this week. But who knows? Mm-hmm. Either way, it doesn't matter. I'm not there, so don't look for me. You won't find me there. So John finishes his rappel descent, and then we get a shot of Barnes, who screams, "Good luck, McLean!" And you can see on his face, it looks like he's freezing his butt off. You know, because he gave away his jacket. You know, even though it's probably not really very cold there, but he's doing a good job of pretending to be this cold. And then we see John stoop down, picks up his equipment, and starts making the trek towards the runway. You know, it's pretty funny. They talked last week about which runway it is, but how would John know how to get there? I mean, who told John, okay, to get to runway, 29 south or something like that, 29 east? I don't know. It was runway 29, from what I remember. And, you know, I don't know how he's going to find it. It's not like they have maps.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume it's either Marv or Barnes, you know, just knows the airport well enough just to say, okay, you're here, just pointing him in the right direction.
Well, Marv isn't here right now to tell him that, so it's got to be Barnes. Barnes has to say, just run in that direction, and you'll get there eventually, you know.
and the one thing, you know, the composition on these shots of just like him in that barren, you know, with the snow, it almost looks like he's walking on the surface of the moon.
Yeah. What's really cool though is right before he like leaves, we get a frame of, you know, the sheets that are tied together just hanging there. They look like really dirty, but someone tied them really well.
Yes.
And you know, Barnes is trying to look at John, trying to find out, you know, trying, the visibility is not very good. And we see just John just running in the distance, you know, run, John, run, you know, and then,
go for it, man.
That's right. And then the shot changes and we see John running towards us. And we see as he's running, he's holding the two, pieces of the pipe that he had, and he's pouring the turpentine on it, you know, and he had already wrapped towards the end of them. You know, some sort of, whether it was the drop cloth or sheets or something like that, in order to light that up, which is pretty smart. And then he throws the can. He just doesn't need it. You know, that's it.
Yeah,
I'm throwing it. I don't need it. So this actually got me thinking. I mean, I know that he's in a dire situation and stuff like that. But, you know, it made me wonder what basically is the fine for littering in Washington, D.C.? Because that's essentially what he's doing here. You know, he's littering.
I suppose, you know, I'm sure he thinks I'm going to go back and pick that up if all goes well, which, you know, So you're asking me how much would a fine for littering be in 1990?
No, I couldn't find what was in 1990, but I'll give you a hint that Washington D.C. changed its laws in 2014. Okay, and since 2014, it's the exact same amount that's the fine. So we're looking at the current fine
now.
Yes, the current fine for littering.
Current fine, I'm going to say $100.
$75.
$75?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And they actually, in the last 9 years, have cracked down on littering. But what they mostly are trying to crack down on is people throwing stuff out of their windows when they're driving.
Well, that's got to be a much bigger fine.
No, that's the fine. This is the fine for that.
75. Wow. Because I could tell you, throwing stuff out of a car window in New York can be upwards of $300.
We will get there. We will get there. We're going to talk about New York also. Right.
That's a different movie.
No, we'll be talking about that this time also. We're not waiting 2 seasons to talk about it. Don't worry. We'll get there. We'll get there today. And so basically, if a police officer, we're first going to talk about DC. So if a police officer sees you dropping garbage, trash, debris, or any kind of other discarded material into public space, waterways, or someone else's private property, you can receive a $75 NOV, which is a notice of violation for littering. All right. Then you have to, once you are given this ticket, you have to show proof of identity. And if you refuse to show proof of identity, they can arrest you. And at that point, you will be fined an additional either $100 to $250 by the court because of the fact that you didn't because you failed to identify yourself properly. Okay, and if you don't show up in court, then the fines get even higher, and it's not a smart thing to do that.
Eesh.
So I mean, if you look at I was able to find for every year since the 1980s, the report, the policeman's report for that year about violations and stuff like that for everything. And some of them discuss littering and some of them don't. Most of them, basically, the ones that were the most accurate that had graphs and information about how many people in each of the 7 districts of DC, of how many NOVs were issued and how many were dismissed and stuff like that. So you can basically get that accurate information from 2011. So I just looked randomly. I got information from 2011, 2020, and 2021. Those are the ones that I found. So how many NOVs do you think were issued in 2011?
Ooh. Is it 4 digits?
Nope. It is 2 digits.
2 digits. Okay. So much less.
Yeah.
Let's say 75.
64. There were 64.
64.
That's it. Wow. And of those 64, 11 of them were dismissed. That for some reason, they got to court and were able to convince the cops that they didn't need that. it's just very, very strange, all right, in 2020, how many were issued? First of all, how many for non-vehicle littering and how much for vehicle littering?
I'm going to say non-vehicle littering, 20. And vehicle littering, 65.
Okay, so in 2020, there were 0 notice NOVs for non-vehicle littering, meaning the cops didn't really care. They're not paying attention to anyone who's just littering on the street. But if they saw you driving and did it, so there were 31 NOVs that were issued in 2020. Remember, they started cracking down on this in 2014, so the number went down. And in addition to those 31, there were 11 people who got warnings. And of all of that, only two of them were dismissed in court.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right.
So again, they're cracking down on these things. Now, okay, let's go 2021. This is the latest information that I was able to get. How many non-vehicle littering and how many vehicle littering?
I'm going to say it was $1, Bob, for non-vehicle.
Don't call me Bob. That's how you get yourself not
And
uninvited for tomorrow.
oh, okay. All right, fine then, Mr. Carey. okay, so it was 31. I'm going to say 25 vehicular notices.
Okay, so the non-vehicle littering, there were actually two.
Two,
And they were
okay.
both in the fourth district, and they were both dismissed. Which again goes
Okay,
back to the idea
so.
that, nobody really cares.
Yeah,
And
but I'm still gonna say I won by Price is Right rules.
yes, because you didn't go over. You are correct.
yes.
See, I'm and then for you said 20 for littering from a vehicle. All right, and
yes.
the answer is actually 30, but seven of those were dismissed. So we're going back to 23 that were actually
Okay.
fined, and there were four warning tickets that were issued.
Interesting that they actually record the warnings.
Yes. Yeah, I was a police officer 20 something years ago here in Israel, and one of the things that I remember from the police academy, and I've mentioned this in the past, is that a policeman has more power than a judge, because a policeman, when you see something, when you see a crime being committed, you can easily just give someone a warning. It could be just a verbal warning, even, saying just don't do it again, and that's it. You don't have to give them a ticket. Once you get to court, then the judge needs to decide based on the merits of the case. He can't just say, oh, all
Yes.
right, I'm just going to give you a warning and that's it. I mean, he can if that's part of the he can dismiss it, but it'll still be on your record. That's the thing. The cop can do it, that it won't be on your record even, unless I guess you're in DC, because apparently in DC they can put it on your record.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could, you could say that there was a warning, but they might not necessarily need to record who they gave the warning
Right,
to.
that could be also. That's true. Yeah. So when you're talking about littering throughout the littering laws throughout the U.S., that basically every state has different laws as to which ones they will actually try to enforce and which ones they don't and stuff like that. So what state do you think is the hardest? Which state do you think has
I'm
the largest fines for it?
largest fines. I'm gonna say, I'm trying to think of who would be a very environmentally conscious state. Maybe Oregon.
Wow. I am very, very impressed. You hit that one. Yeah,
Really?
yes. The state of Oregon, if you throw a lighted cigarette or other tobacco product that's considered a Class B misdemeanor, and it's punishable for a fine of up to $2,500 and 5 years in prison. Okay. Now, I find this ironic that isn't
Wow.
Oregon the first state to legalize marijuana? So I guess, I guess it's the same thing,
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you could smoke all the weed you want, but any tobacco products, you're in trouble,
That's
Buster.
right. And
You better watch out.
if you throw any of these in water or on highways or on someone else's property, that's considered a Class A misdemeanor, and it carries with it a maximum fine of $6,250 and up to 10 years in prison. That's just
They
amazing.
are serious.
Seriously.
Wow. Well, because I've met people from Oregon who tell me always that they are really big into recycling. Like that is a huge campaign and movement within the state. So I'm not surprised that they would be just as harsh on littering.
Apparently. I mean, that's just nuts.
Wow.
I mean, I see people throw cigarettes out of cars all the time, you know, and obviously they're lit. So I don't know. I guess in my country, it's less of an issue. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest way to get around that is just don't smoke.
Oh, of course. I don't smoke. I've never even taken a puff ever. You know, I'm not even like Clinton, who says I didn't never inhaled. I didn't even take a puff.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, if you go through all the different states, it's unbelievable the different the different things. So we said that we would get into New York because you know that's where you're from. So in New York,
yes,
the if you litter on highways or adjacent lands, your first conviction is a fine of up to how much? What did you say you thought it was?
350,
and okay. A requirement to perform services for a public or nonprofit corporation, association, institution, or agency not to exceed 10 hours. Meaning you need to do 10 hours of community service for littering on the highway.
Yep.
Okay. And yep. If you get caught a second time,
the orange vest gang.
That's yeah. Right. if you get caught a second time, how much do you think you got to pay?
I'm going to say double that.
That is correct. 700 and a requirement to do 15 hours of community service. Now, if you do it on the railway,
wow.
Then it's a little different. It's 250 for, and then up to eight hours of community service. And a second time is 500 plus 8 hours of community service, meaning the 8 hours stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the fines are then put in what's known as the New York Subway Littering Prevention Fund. Okay.
Yeah, I'm guessing they're probably lower because usually you're not in a car when you're littering there.
Yeah. Okay, you're throwing them out of a moving train window or
yeah, like
no.
Well, no, I would assume usually it would be like if you're on a platform at a station, you know, and someone's just dumb enough to throw something on the tracks.
Yeah. Well, it's better to probably do it in New York as opposed to New Jersey, because New Jersey, the first time the fine can be anywhere between $100 and $500 with somewhere between 20 to 40 hours of community service. Okay.
Wow.
If your second conviction is within 6 months of the first one, then the fine is between $250 and $1,000 with up to 80 hours of community service or up to 60 days of imprisonment. So if you're going to do it in Long Island.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember because, you know, in high school, I used to take the Staten Island Rapid Transit every day to school. And a lot of times you would just see, you know, idiot kids doing stuff, and a lot of times transit cops, you know, often just, you know, catching them and, you know, giving them those kinds of fines. You know, and a lot of them just, you know, and a lot, I remember thinking just how stupid it was that people would just throw stuff onto the track when there's literally a garbage can 2 feet behind
that's
them.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's just crazy. I mean, again, we can go through all 50 states. Well, we're not going to, but
yeah.
I mean, some of these are just crazy.
Yeah. Just, you know, if you happen to be in Portland,
some of them it depends on how you know how heavy the it is of what you've thrown. You know.
Oh, really? Yeah. So okay. So you know. Yeah, better a bag of chips than your album collection.
Apparently, yeah. So, like, for instance, in Texas, okay, if it weighs 5 pounds or less, it's a Class C misdemeanor with a punishable fine up to $500. If it's between 5 and 500 pounds, it's a class B misdemeanor, which is punishable of a fine of up to $500 plus imprisonment of up to 30 days. If it's if it's between 500 and 1,000 pounds, or for commercial purposes, it's a class A misdemeanor with a fine of up to $4,000 and imprisonment of up to a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
So and if it's more than more than that, it's 10,000. If it's more than 1,000 pounds, it's up to $10,000 fine and 2 years imprisonment. You know. Damn. Yeah, I don't know. I think you got to stick with New York if you're gonna let it.
Yeah. Although somehow, even though he's a cop, I don't think that's at the forefront of John McClane's mind.
No, of course
right
not. Of course not. But it's still fun to look at these things. You know.
Of course, of course.
So then he takes out his trusted Zippo, and we see him light it up. And he only lights up the Zippo. That's it. You know, we don't see him. We see him move the Zippo towards, you know, the I guess the dripping drop cloth, but we don't get to see we don't get to see it light up at this point.
Well, it's of course because he's gonna need it. Because once you light those things, you can't use them in the next take.
That's probably also.
So that's why.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. And then we hear some beeping, and we see a whole bunch of airplane knobs and letters. It says Airways, and we see outer, middle, marker. So, you know, we've been talking the last few weeks about the outer marker. So, you know, then we see the lights start flashing. I don't know if it really does that, but, you know, it's done for us for the effect that we now know they've reached the outer marker. You know, and then we.
Yes.
And then we get a shot of we're back with, you know, Chief O'Brien.
My man.
Chief O'Brien.
Cole Meany.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we hear him say, Dulles, this is Windsor 114 inside the outer market, outer marker. So what's really funny is that, you know, if he has the, you know, the indicator switch that tells him that he's at the outer marker, my assumption is that in Dulles, they know it also.
Yeah.
You know, they know where it is. And then, Stuart, we see Stuart again, and Stuart responds, Roger 114. This is Dulles Tower. We have radar contact and show you on ILS. You're in the glide path and you're looking good. Now, I've never noticed this until this watching, you know, doing my research for this, because based on what it says in the script that we were talking about the last few weeks, how Stuart keeps changing his voice because these are different people that he's supposed to be speaking to each time. So I've now noticed that he does change his accent slightly each time, you know, to make it seem as if he's a different person giving this information, you know?
Yeah. He's got a little bit of a Southern lilt to him here.
Correct. You know, and we get to see, you know, Garber once again and Miller. You know, these guys are all nice and happy, you know, to be sitting there looking at what's going on, you know, getting ready for something to happen because they all know it's going to happen.
Has anyone commented on how somehow Garber to me, just the, I don't know if it's hairstyle or what, for some reason he looks like a dead ringer for Christopher Guest.
Okay, I can understand. Why. I can understand how you can say how you can think that, just because of the way it's flipped back at this at this point. Have you never seen Don Harvey in anything before?
I mean, yes, yeah, I have. It just in this particular role, and with the hairstyle. I mean, he's obviously he's got a thicker build than Guest, but the facial features, for some reason, it looks a little bit more like a young Christopher Guest.
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
Yeah.
I definitely can see that. And then we continue with, you know, and then we're back with John, and we see that he's, you know, standing there trying to signal the plane.
The torches have been lit.
Torches have been lit for as you said, for this take. They want to make sure that they're doing. I mean, he does it pretty well. You know, I gotta say it looks like he's doing a lot of exercise. You know, waving those torches back and forth.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's really a shame trying to figure out, is that really going to be helpful?
Yes, or not? And also, is he on the right? Is he on the right runway? You know, is he facing the right direction? The plane is going to be coming from in front of me or behind me? You know, John is pretty smart. You know, and if you look, you'll see that there's like, you know, when we see a long shot of John, we see like that there's smoke, or actually it's not really, it's supposed to be like snow that's being pushed by wind or something like that. But since we know there's really no snow there, so it just looks really funny trying to figure out what it is that's moving behind him. You know, you can see it by second 40 like and fans. Stuff like that. Yeah, it's definitely the that's what I would say also. And then we get a close up of John, and it looks like he's really struggling. And I don't know if you noticed this, but the canister that he threw far away from him is actually now at his feet. So I guess he did decide that he does not want to litter and have to pay that $75 fine. So he brought it closer, and I'm gonna take care of it beforehand. You know.
Yeah.
And then the shot changes, and we're back in the tower, and we see Lorenzo start pointing, and he goes, "There's somebody out there." So I gotta say, he's got
what's that Jagoff doing?
He's got great eyesight that he can see that.
Well, yeah, and to me, the marvel is that they could see John from in there, and yet the planes can't yet. which is just funny. I mean, I'm sure you have that layer of clouds and fog, but still.
Yes.
Well,
I mean, the planes aren't expecting to see him because they think that they're, you know, they're not going to want to see someone, you know, hanging, you know, flying at 200 feet.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone else commented on the marvel that Dennis Franz has such a thick, recognizable Chicago accent, yet he never plays a cop in Chicago?
In this movie, he has played Chicago cops. Did you ever see the movie The Package?
Oh, okay. Because I always think of like this and Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue.
Yeah. No, I understand that. I knew what you were going with, but he's one of the. You know, he's one of those Chicago guys. Yeah, you know, I'm surprised he wasn't in The Fugitive with everyone else. You know, they have this group of Chicago actors who all appear in a whole bunch of movies, you know, and TV shows and stuff like that. That all take place around Chicago, and you know, he fits in with that. Let's put it that way. And after he says this, so then Trudeau starts looking, and you see him like squinting with his eyes a little bit, and then he walks over and picks up a pair of binoculars. Like, what the hell are you looking at? And he picks up the binoculars and starts looking out, and everyone, you see like everyone just standing there now just looking, and there's like one woman who has her hand around the waist of one of the men. You know, looks very professional.
Yeah, it's well, the other odd choice here is that there's no way, I mean, because it's so difficult for them to see, there's no way we could see John from this angle. And the fact that I find it interesting that they would show this shot of the control room with everyone facing away from the camera, where we're just looking at the back of everyone's head. And I thought, you
bald,
know, to me,
bald,
like the,
not
the
bald,
more
bald ponytail.
Yeah. Oh, it's interesting that they wouldn't do a shot, maybe, you know, an exterior shot of them through the window so we could actually see their faces and, you know.
Well, I think they do that because they're really, really far away. We're going to see later that is very far away.
Yes. Yes.
You know, even though in the script a few weeks, I think last week, Trudeau says something about the fact that he wants them to see it. You know, the Stewart wants them to see it, so he's doing something close. But this isn't close at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And So Trudeau starts looking through the binoculars, and then he notices it's John. He goes, "It's McClane, Christ!" And then we get a close up shot again of John, still trying to wave him off, doing his exercises. And that's actually how this minute ends.
Okay.
Again, once again, you see all the fake snow, flying behind him. Plus, you can also see like some sort of light that's coming from above. If you take a look there, it looks very strange. It looks ominous, because it's not the plane yet. So, what is that? But also, if you look, this is supposed to be a runway, but I don't see any of the lights on the side of the runway even turned off. So he's just standing
No.
there on the street. They're like, "John,
Yeah,
just stand
yeah.
out there in the field. We'll make it look like it's,
Yeah, probably with all the snow blankets they couldn't figure out yeah, they didn't think to mount those or whatever, yeah, it's just funny, I mean, 'cause there's so much negative space.
And that's pretty much how the minute ends. So, do you have anything else you want to say about the minute before we get into the script?
No, I mean th this is to me this is the real heart of the movie. Die Hard 2 does not stick as much in my mind as Die Hard or Die Hard with a Vengeance, but the one thing I do is this sequence that we're talking about this week.
Okay, which is why you
The
chose to be on this week.
yes. And to me it's what makes it stand out, especially from the original.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've listened to the commentary, so you know this also. But for anyone who's listening, Renny Harlin had a really hard time selling this entire scene. We'll talk about it a little bit during the week about how what he needed to cut. And what he was able to keep in order to give us that emotional connection to what's going on here. So, So in the script, so it starts off with the it says in the British cockpit, the crew reacts as their ILS lights up. High fives all around. I'm so glad they cut that. And then it says in the tower, they hear the sound of engines. Trudeau says, "Oh God, no." A technician says, "Can't we cut in, jam them?" Trudeau says, "Everything's dead." Lorenzo points, "There's somebody out there." Light sizzles in the distance, dances. Trudeau fumbles up a pair of binoculars, looks. Christ, it's McClane. He'll get himself killed. McClane has made two torches from the wads of fabric wound on the scaffold pieces. Now he uses his lighter to ignite them. He waves the impromptu flares. In a crazy pattern, we hear the approaching plane. Barnes looks out the window of the of the Annex Skywalk. Come on, come on, see the torch, see the torch. Everyone watches in the tower as the dancing lights and listens too. And then we hear the conversation between O'Brien and Stewart. That actually stays the same. And that's all we have for this minute. I like the way they did in the movie. I'm glad that they switched things around from what was in the original script. I think it just works a little bit better. It flows much better this way.
And it really more firmly establishes that Stewart is in control of the situation.
Correct. Correct. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called McClane Monday, where my guests will give their top five Bruce Willis performances. So, Eddie, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Sure. It was funny looking through this. I was surprised a bit as to how many of Bruce Willis's later performances I preferred to his more stuff from the 80s and 90s.
Interesting. Okay.
So just I will give one quick honorable mention just because I can't help myself. That didn't make this list was Unbreakable.
Okay.
Number five is a movie that I don't think was has been talked about as much. It kind of got lost in the shuffle, but it's 16 Blocks from 2006. Directed by Richard Donner, and that is a real like tense close quarters thriller, where he plays a detective who's trying to help a witness get to court on time.
I liked it, but that's a movie I didn't like. Some of the twists weren't that great.
Number four, Armageddon from 1998. One of the few Michael Bay movies that I really do appreciate, and I really enjoy the chemistry that he has with Ben Affleck, and when he gets to go off on supposedly smart people who have dumb ideas, and I think this is one of the better examples of that. Number three, Looper from 2012. Another great sci-fi piece, and I think like the really the last great performance that he put in in his career. Number two, it was hard to figure out which Die Hard was going to be on this list, but I went with Die Hard with a Vengeance, just because seeing John McClane in his natural environment in New York is something that I find really special, and the sarcasm and wit that he has, I think, is at another level here. And number one, which I feel like might be a bit controversial, but to me, I've always seen Bruce Willis as someone who could have been in that category with great noir actors from the 40s, like Robert Mitchum or Humphrey Bogart. And to me, the movie that best displays him in that sense is Sin City from 2005.
Okay.
Who plays Detective Hardigan in the That Yellow Bastard segment.
Yeah. All right, great. So, Eddie, why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with you? Where can they find Little Eddie?
You can find me on Twitter at Lil Eddie O'Hare. I will be tweeting a bit more often because I have some projects in the wings. Also, if you listen to the Super Live Adventure podcast, which is a comedy pop culture podcast hosted by John Saluga and Chris Sorrentino. I call in there with capsule movie reviews. Every time I go to a movie theater, I always call those guys, tell them what I saw and whether or not I liked it. And they're just a bunch of rollicking fun. If you want to go back here to some of my other works, you could check out the Wicked Theory podcast or the DC TV report. My co-host Sarah Netsley, Bill Sweeney, and I just recorded a reunion special for the DC TV report that discussed the series finale of The Flash and the end of the Arrowverse as we know it. Mm-hmm. I may have something in waiting in the wings. I'll wait until at minute 60 to give you some more details about that. Ooh. So stay tuned.
All right. Mm-hmm. See, everyone, there's a reason to come back and listen all week to Eddie. You'll never know when he's gonna tell when he's gonna give it to you. Maybe he'll give it to you on Friday, maybe Thursday, maybe Wednesday, but come back every day. You can try and find out these spoilers.
Ooh, yes.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just to search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. Or you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and